in the world, but it is particularly important in the United States. The United States being the center of capitalist power in the world. So the fact that a growing number of American people are questioning this economic system, are seeking alternatives to this economic system, is something that fills us with enthusiasm and hope that we have allies, and our allies are getting stronger in the United States.
Yes, and I want to make very clear to you that we feel the same thing. That's why it's so important to hear your story about the victory of the two senators and the two representatives from an explicitly socialist perspective, that you have an audience and you have support in Puerto Rico. That makes us stronger here in the mainland, and, you know, so that we can, in a sense, help each other. In the little bit of time that we have left, what would you say is the thing that we here on the mainland can do to make your struggle more successful?
Well, I think there are three areas, three things that we have to address. One of them is self-determination for Puerto Rico. As you said, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, and the Puerto Rican people should be allowed to decide what they want to do regarding their relationship with the United States. We need a fair and balanced process of self-determination through which the Puerto Rican people can decide if they want to become a state, if they want to become independent, if they want to become freely associated with the United States, which option they want. There should be a self-determination process, and Congress should be pushed to take action in that direction. Secondly, we need to cancel Puerto Rico's debt. Puerto Rico has a public debt which is $70 billion, cannot be paid unless you impose on the Puerto Rican people unacceptable sacrifices. So we should struggle to have that debt canceled. That's the second thing. And the third thing is we have to reconstruct Puerto Rico's economy, as I said, which is completely destroyed. And for that, the Puerto Rican government has to adopt new economic policies, but we also need Congress to assume its responsibility to fund Puerto Rico's economic reconstruction. So in the same fashion that you demand that Congress in the United States provide for the inner cities and provide job programs for the unemployed and so on and so forth, Congress should also provide for the economic reconstruction of Puerto Rico. So self-determination, debt cancellation, and economic reconstruction. These three things are crucial for Puerto Rico's future.
Well, we've run out of time, and you have been wonderfully clear and eloquent in what you've had to say. Thank you so much, Senator Bernabe. It's been a pleasure to deal with you, and I hope that my audience has learned as much as I have, and that we will work together in the months and years coming. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And to all of you in my audience, I look forward to speaking with you again next week when we will continue this kind of programming.
The previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolf, heard Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. It is now 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook, coming up.
We're sorry. The number you have reached, 99.5 WBAI, is now off the hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, I made it. I'm here.
You're here. Good. Awesome. And joining us through telephony, the magic of telephony, is Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Gila.
Hello.
And Alex.
Good evening.
How are you all doing this week?
We're doing well. Gila and I just have had a full day.
We certainly have. Through the good graces of our hero, TurboVax, we went to the Javits Center today and got our first shots.
Get out. No, seriously, get out, because I am jealous. Wow. So,
you want to see my Band-Aid?
The thing that we talked about 2 weeks ago on these very airwaves, you used to your advantage to get a vaccine this early. Wow, I am impressed.
Very much, yes.
Tell us what you did as far as using the TurboVax system. How did you get the appointment?
Absolutely. So I was I had Twitter open, and I saw that TurboVax mentioned that like 7,000 appointments had just opened at the Javits Center. And I said, well, this is worth checking out. And I think within 10 minutes of figuring it out, I had secured an appointment both for myself and for Rob. And we went today, and it was honestly a very smooth process from start to finish. We were inside the Javits Center for 45 minutes, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was fantastic. I cannot say enough good about the whole process.
Wow. That is incredible. That's amazing. I'm so happy that you guys managed to do that. One by one, we're all getting the vaccine. And I hope that we're able to help the listeners as much as possible. 2 weeks ago, the show is in the archives, 2600.com/off the hook. You can see all of our shows. And we talked about various tips, ways that you can beat the system and get an appointment, focusing primarily on New York, but we are willing to look into any other state that has a system. There are always tricks, and people in the hacker community are sharing these tricks, are helping people get appointments. This is when our skills really, really come in handy. I must have gotten a couple of dozen appointments for people over the past couple of weeks, and it always works. It always works at some point. You don't get what you want necessarily. You might not get it tomorrow. Might not be until mid-April. But at least it's something. And even if you don't get it immediately, you will get it fairly soon. Things are looking good. So the important thing is to keep trying and to take it seriously.
If you have any stories about it, you can write us oth@2600.com.
Yes. Alex, looks like you have something to say.
No, I think it's wonderful that Rob and Gila were able to do this, and that you've been helping so many people as well. I mean, this is I think a great thing. We're hopefully well on our way towards mass vaccination and something like herd immunity.
Yeah, it's especially good. People who are good at video games, which I'm not, by the way, I think they have special skills here that would definitely help out, because the way the New York State system works, if you have an auto refresh going, well, the first thing you have to do, you have to stop the auto refresh so you don't lose what just came up on the screen. And then you have to quickly go into the window within a window, scroll down, because the select button doesn't appear right away. You have to scroll down. You can use a combination of a tab and return keys to do this quickly, but you have to get it in the right order or you lose. It literally takes place within 3 seconds, and that's how the system is right now. And I can't imagine people who are not at all computer literate attempting this. Think of, you know, your elderly parents or grandparents or aunts or uncles. Help them out. Contact them. See if they've gotten their appointments yet. Other people are able to get appointments through doctors, or I know NYU, if you're a patient there, they have a whole lot of openings. There are all kinds of, and of course, pharmacies are offering vaccines as well. One trick somebody mentioned to me is to call a pharmacy and ask if they have a cancellation list. And if they do, that means if they have leftover doses in a particular day and people haven't shown up, they'll call you, assuming that you qualify. And for pharmacies right now, it's only 65 and over. The comorbidities aren't part of the pharmacies. But they will be soon at some point. And when they get to, I think 1C is the next category here in New York State, a lot more people will be eligible as well.
Any other vaccine stories that,
go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, sure. I was just going to mention that, you know, in light of Rob Aguila getting the vaccine today in the New York Post, there was, at least this morning in the New York Post, there was an article about all of the various disparate systems. I mean, it was very similar to what we had described 2 weeks ago.
It probably was. I mean, the New York Post, really, you read that rag, it probably is word for word what we said.
Well,
it wouldn't be the first time.
It does have some good local news, I think. Look, it's not you know, the pinnacle of truth in any sense, but, you know, look, I do like it for the stories, especially early in the morning. But in reading through this article, it was very long for a New York Post article and about all of these different systems and the different manners in which you can try to obtain a vaccine, whether it's going through a pharmacy, whether it's going through the TurboVax site, whether it's going through medical systems. And it was just obvious to anybody who was reading this that it is so disconnected and so discombobulated in a sense that, you know, people are starting to really just throw up their hands and say, well, I guess now, even though I'm eligible, now is not my time. But I don't think that that's right. I think we need to continue to encourage people to try to use these systems, to try to figure out how to navigate effectively around them, to listen to the show that we did 2 weeks ago, especially with the trick, Emmanuel, that you had identified that allows the page to refresh with additional vaccine appointments simply by changing the zip code. Mm-hmm. And I would really encourage people to use that tip and trick.
That's the New York City system. It's changing the last digit of the zip code makes the page refresh. You just have to keep doing that over and over again.
Which is great. And that's on the New York City system. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or it was last time I checked.
Yeah. And look, and to continue to look outside of New York as well, but always to keep an eye on the changing regulations about out-of-state vaccines. You know, even if you are able to get a vaccine, let's say in a place like New Jersey or Pennsylvania, and you may live in New York or surrounding areas, if you're an out-of-stater, the day of the vaccine, you always want to make sure that you are up to date with respect to whatever documentation they may require to get that vaccine, because it could change overnight.
Yeah, you don't want to take an interstate trip for nothing. No. In fact, you'd have to take two because you have to get the second shot. Rob Gila, what did they tell you about the second shot? When do you have to come back for that?
They said that our second shot appointments have already been made, that we just have to show up 3 weeks from today. If we can come around the same time of day, that's great. Mm-hmm. And all we need to bring with us for the second shot is our card.
Yeah, the card that they gave us today when we got our first shot.
You get a card?
Yeah, it's an CDC immunization card.
Really? And I can show that at various places for discounts.
It's a part of
that card.
Yeah.
It was actually very funny. In the observation section, there was because the site at the Javits Center is staffed by the National Guard, right? So there are military personnel walking around in uniform. And one of them said, okay, now if you're going to take a picture of your card, don't put it on social media. And he walked over to a young person who was sitting there with his phone and said, I said, don't put it on social media. It was very funny because this thing has your full name and your date of birth on it.
And so a National Guard person is going around giving cyber tips to kids?
Basically, that is what happened today. Yes.
Wow.
It was a fascinating day from start to finish.
Hey, I'd like to play a piece from one of our favorite commentators, who we played a couple of weeks ago, actually, involving certain events that are taking place in the country right now. This is from Corey Forrester, who has a lot to say about a lot and is a great comedian as well as others. But listen to some of these comments on some developments taking place regarding the vaccine in other states.
Hey, Governor Greg Abbott, have you done it? Have you got it out of your system? Do you feel like all the conservatives and Republicans think of you as the rootin' tootin' shootin' Texas fucking cowboy that you want to be, looking all tough? We can't have no mask mandates. This ain't really freedom. People are gonna fucking die. There's a huge difference in this f***ing Orwellian bullshit that you all conjure up in your brain where nobody has any freedom and Big Brother's watching you all the time. There's a huge difference in that and just being f***ing safe to be f***ing safe because you care about people. And you care. Also, when did you and Marjorie Taylor Greene become the scientists all of a sudden? Now you're, well, because of all the vaccines and we can just open back up to 100 billion. Or is it that you thought like, hey, you know what? We can just open Texas back up. Since there's not as many people, since we let a lot of them f***ing freeze to death, naturally, there will be more social distancing going on. Is that the logic going through your brain? This is so goddamn dumb. The f***ing checks aren't even here, all right? Yes, people are getting vaccinated. Things are looking better. But we're still f***ing not there. Jesus God, how much more... Do you old white men gotta sling your dicks around while everybody f***ing dies and suffers? F*** you, man. Come on.
Well, I could not say it better. Corey Forrester with more commentary. Look him up. It's on Twitter. I'm sure YouTube all over the place. What do you guys think?
That was a bit subtle. I'm not quite sure I understand completely what they're trying to say.
He should be more direct, I think, yes.
He's, of course, referencing the recent disaster with power outages and the overall sort of free system. It's a kind of a nice parallel to his redress over the use of the term freedom, because that's exactly what created that isolated power system, and so many people were affected in Texas.
Right. But also, I mean, just in the last day or two, having all the restrictions pretty much lifted, like, you know, just wishing it away, saying that because things are getting better, you know what, no more masks, no more crowd control. And this is how we lose. This is how all the gains that we have made, by all the sacrifices we have made, that is how it's lost, through idiocy, through the governors of Texas, of Mississippi, of Florida. You know, there's not enough attention being paid to the idiocy going on in these places and the people that will die as a result of it. It's really disgusting, and I think we need to focus a lot more attention on that. Okay, so we have other stories to Alex, do you have something to say as well?
Well, I want to provide a short anecdote about this very situation, which is, you know, I went to a veterinarian this past week here in Pennsylvania. My dog, a beagle, she wound up hurting her back, slipping on some ice or something, and she wasn't herself, so I had to bring her to the vet. It was not the ordinary vet that I would usually go to. The vet I usually go to is very cautious about coming into the office. They come to your car, they take the dog, you never step foot into the office. This other vet, though, that I went to, I won't name it, but it was the polar opposite, where you took your dog or a cat, whatever it is, whatever your animal was, into the waiting room, and you're in there in this enclosed space, and they weren't following any kind of mask mandate. The employees had masks on, but people could be in the waiting room without any mask on. In fact, there was one individual, one man there, who was probably in his 30s, a big dog, you know, drove a pickup truck, and he's just sitting there in this enclosed space with no mask on whatsoever. And I'm thinking to myself, how goddamn inconsiderate can you be to all these people around you? And I'm thinking about it from his perspective, in that he probably never got sick and doesn't believe in COVID or thinks the virus is some kind of hoax. Who knows? You know, I'm putting all these thoughts into his head, you know, trying to empathize with.
You're also
person.
Assuming he drives a pickup truck.
No, he did drive.
Oh, he did drive. Okay, sorry.
But you have to think about this. If this person has been able to get through this past year without having contracted the virus, it's in large part due to other people wearing masks, right? Because masks mm-hmm. are about protecting those around you. It's common courtesy. It's like what the you know, this comedian that you just played had mentioned. It's not about protecting yourself in as much as it is about protecting other people around you. And I saw something in that waiting room that I never saw before. There was a woman who was trying to comply in some respects with the mask mandate by using her hair around her face. She wrapped her hair around her face. She had her hair wrapped around her face, so I couldn't figure
out. That's not going to help. None. That doesn't help, Alex. That's wishful thinking.
Her long locks of brown hair she's using as a mask. I'd never seen that before in my life. I thought to myself, I have to get the hell out of here.
This is
dangerous. And I felt weird, but you know, I made up some excuse saying, you know, I need to take some work calls. I'm just going to be hanging out in the parking lot. They seem to get it. But in any event, that's my mask anecdote from last week.
Now, where did this happen?
This is in Pennsylvania.
Oh, in Pennsylvania. I was about to say, yeah, give me the address of the place in New York. I'll go down there myself, you know, because I do see a lot of idiocy. I do see stupidity, but I also see it challenged, and I see it overwhelmed by smart people who are following guidelines. And, you know, that is so important, and you have to reinforce that wherever possible. But, you know, it all goes to leadership. If you have a president or a governor or a mayor who is telling you that it doesn't apply to you and that science is subjective, you're going to make the wrong decisions. And that's where you lay the blame, and that's where we should be focusing the attention. Not seeing that enough, and that's really tragic because we could be so much further along, and we are making great strides because of the vaccine, because of the effort so many people are making, but we could be so much better. So just extremely frustrating. Okay, so we have some interesting stories. Actually, a very interesting story, which is kind of the elephant in the room. We talked about Parler over the past few weeks, months, but there's another conservative social media platform that we haven't really talked about very much called Gab. Have you heard about Gab? Have we talked about Gab? I don't think we've really mentioned it. Well, it's a right-wing social media website, I guess, is one way to describe it, but it's really more than that. They have been hacked. Yeah, this always seems to happen. The CEO Andrew Torba said on Twitter, and I'm not making this up, said that demon hackers were to blame. Demon hackers were to blame. Well, I mean, okay, let's look at the good in that. Okay, by saying demon hackers, he's implying that hackers by default aren't demons. So you have to call them demon hackers. Maybe hackers are good in his eyes, but these are demon hackers. But then he went and used a transphobic slur to describe them, which really is revealing, quite revealing. Now, Wired actually reported that a hacker who goes by the name Jack Sparrow, and I can't even tell you what letters are capitalized and what letters are not capitalized in that name, Jack Sparrow and my little anonymous revival project. That's a great handle, I think.
MLARP.
What?
MLARP.
What does that mean? Oh, you mean you're spelling it out? Okay.
I was trying to make sense
of it. Does that mean something?
I don't know. I tried to make sense of it. That's all I could come up with.
Ever since all the real names were taken, I can't keep up. You know, people are spelling things with numbers and symbols now.
Got to keep up.
Anyway, Jack Sparrow? I don't even know. Someone tell me how to pronounce it. And my little anonymous revival project carried out the hack to expose Gab's users. Private messages from some 15,000 Gab users were used to create a data set of more than 40 million posts from the site. 40 million posts, including private posts, user profiles, some users' hashed passwords, passwords for groups. They were all affected by the hack, which used an SQL injection vulnerability. Might have some more details on that in a bit, to siphon some 70 gigs of data. 70 gigs. Now, activist data transparency group Distributed Denial of Secrets, known as DDoS Secrets, I guess is how you pronounce it, plans to share the data with researchers and journalists, but says it's not releasing it publicly due to privacy concerns. In a simpler or more ordinary time, it would be an important sociological resource, according to a blog post on that wiki site. In 2021, though, it's also a record of the culture and the exact statements surrounding not only an increase in extremist views and actions, but an attempted coup. Now, speaking of which, this is all very relevant because tomorrow is supposedly the day that Trump comes back and takes the helm at the White House. March 4th, the day that lives in conspiracy theorists' minds as the day of infamy. And they are basically, I think they canceled the House of Representatives tomorrow because they really think something is going to happen. Honestly, I don't see how it's possible with all the National Guard basically taking over the city there. But you know what? If they want to try that, I think they should. I think they should show their true colors and show up. And, you know, now we'll have more information on these people. That's how you find out.
And the information just continues with, I think, the initial change from one platform to another. The real area of interest, and I'm excited to know more about it, is that transfer of people, at least in sort of the real sort of academic sense. I think we're all ready to go, and we're going to be able to learn a little bit more about that tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Basically, concerning Gab, they've had an 800% spike in traffic since January 6th, since the attack on the Capitol. Its registered user numbers have doubled. That's according to National Public Radio. The Anti-Defamation League has called for an investigation into Gab to determine whether the social media platform intentionally aided or abetted people who were involved in the riot. Now, this guy Torba found Gab in 2016. It was styled as a free speech alternative to other social media sites that didn't have enough free speech, apparently. It gained notoriety in 2018. You might remember this, when a man posted an anti-Semitic message on the site before driving to Pittsburgh and killing 11 people in a synagogue. Gab removed the account and cooperated with investigators, but they were dropped by their hosting platform and by PayPal, and its app was kicked out of both Google and Apple's app stores for violating hate speech policies. So, same old thing all over again. Wow. So, Alex, I believe we have some people joining us now.
We do indeed. We are very lucky to have Zan, who is one of the major players with distributed denial of secrets, here with us tonight to talk about the Gab hack, the Gab leaks, and what distributed denial of secrets is doing with this data, how they are distributing it to researchers, to threat analysts, to people who are doing kind of analysis and research with respect to extremist groups and insurrections. And with that, let me hand it over to Zan and say welcome to Off the Hook. We're so delighted to have you here.
Yes, welcome.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let me just ask right away, Zan. Distributed denial of secrets. People are going to right away say, "Is this another version of WikiLeaks? What is the difference between these two organizations?"
Well, we are a transparency organization. We do believe that information should have the right to be free. We do accept leaks, but we are a little different from WikiLeaks in that. We are a little bit more cooperative in our approach. We make decisions together as a group. We are not run solely on the whims of one person. We like to make our decisions based on everybody's wishes, not just on the wishes of one. We are run primarily by queer and trans people. We try to also take the wishes of the source more into account. For example, with the recent Gab leaks, the way that we decided to distribute it was not only based on privacy concerns for the users it contained in the leaks, but also based on what the source wanted. The source agreed with how we released it. The source didn't want it as a public release. Oh, I'm sorry. You might see a cat or two.
There's always a cat.
Yeah.
They're quite welcome. Yeah.
But the source didn't want it released as a full public release. The source did want it released as a limited distribution, or what we at DDoS describe as a limdis. So we very much do also take the wishes of the source into the account, how they want it released, when they want it released, in what format they want it released as well.
Well, I was struck by that. You mentioned the differences between Wikipedia and your organization. I can't imagine who the one you're referring to might be, but we'll just skip over that.
I can't really imagine.
as far as the release itself, what you folks have been doing seems really socially responsible as far as not wanting to invade anyone's privacy, reveal information of a personal nature, and only revealing this to journalists, researchers, people who will treat it responsibly when it certainly could have been.
Well, especially in Gab, a lot was pulled. And in it, we feel the data is a very valuable data set for people who want to research things like extremism and things like that. But also in there was a lot of stuff that isn't applicable. You know, Gab is a very big platform. And while it is mostly a right-wing platform, there are just people that are there to talk about things like their day or their pets or what their kids did on any particular day, and they don't deserve to be doxxed. They don't deserve to have their life splayed out to the world for everybody to see. They don't deserve to have their email address put out there, their password cracked. They don't deserve that. And while there is an undeniable interest for researchers and journalists that do things like track extremist groups, track hate groups, and things like that, you know, there absolutely is an undeniable value to that part of the data set. We also did want to preserve the privacy of people that were just there to talk about their day or their pets or their kids or, you know, complain about work or things like that. They do not deserve to have their lives laid bare like that.
No, that makes sense. I can't help but think that if the tables were turned, the right-wing extremists would say that this is evidence of a Pizzagate-type conspiracy, and that these private messages are actually coded messages, and we have to reveal them all so that we can see if they're talking about cats, they're actually talking about insurrection or, you know, whatnot. And I'm glad to see cooler heads are prevailing here.
I mean, one of the things, excuse me, that the Gab that Andrew Torba, the CEO of Gab, said was that, oh, you know, this is something that they're just doing for us, which is absolutely untrue. Distributed denial of secrets has multiple data sets that are considered limited distribution for a number of reasons that, you know, researchers or journalists or whoever want to get access to. They actually have to get in contact with distributed denial of secrets. They have to explain why they want the data set and things like that. We have a whole section on our website for data sets like that, where, you know, it's just not of interest to the general public. That information does not need to be out there to the general public, but may, for one reason or another, be of interest to researchers or journalists or whoever.
How about law enforcement? I mean, are you looking at a potential crime scene here as far as planning for things like coups and insurrections?
I mean, law... Maybe, but I think one of the things that we really want to focus on is getting it out to researchers who do track things like hate groups, because I think that a data set like this is really important to track the evolution of hate online. The internet has become such a vector and such an echo chamber for hate groups. So it's so important to track how these things evolve online, not only so we can keep communities safe, but also so that, you know, maybe we can break that echo chamber, find out what they're saying, what they're doing, how they evolve. And maybe from that, we can learn how to break that echo chamber and maybe de-radicalize. We can find new ways to maybe de-radicalize.
Yeah. And along those lines, Zan, especially with regard to the issue of law enforcement having access to this, there may be evidence of criminal activity in this, but it's 70 gigabytes of data. And today we often lose track of what 70 gigabytes is. If you think about something, that amount of data in comparison to the Panama Papers, which was 2.6 terabytes, right, of data, which was a massive amount of data. 70 gigabytes sounds like it's not a lot of data, but it really, really is. 70 gigs is a huge amount of data.
Especially when you're considering it's text messages and DMs and password hashes, and these are things that normally don't take up a lot of space, and yet you have 70 gigs of it.
Yeah, I believe there are no pictures or videos or anything like that included in this, right?
Mm-hmm. No, there's no pictures or videos or any sort of media. The data does have the information that a university lab could use to download the media. It notes like Gab posts that had pictures attached or video, and gives you URLs. And so if, a particular research outfit wanted to use that to then retrieve that additional media, they could. But that didn't seem like the priority for us here.
So 70 gigs really is a lot if it's just text. It is a lot. I mean, 64K is a lot if it says something significant.
Well, text and links to more data, presumably. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Go ahead, Alex.
And along those lines, too, we're talking about this is a massive amount of data. You mentioned, Zan, and rightly so, that there's a lot of contact information. There's a lot of ways that this data can be misused. And I think one of the things that we often forget about, too, is when these things happen, when the Parler leaks happened and Internet archivists were able to scarf down massive amounts of Parler-related data, and while it was in its death throes and it's still being resurrected in weird places and platforms these days, the communities on these platforms tend to break apart. They tend to segment or balkanize in certain ways. And if you release this data publicly, if you just released it all out, these extremist groups could then use that data, use that contact information to reform, to regroup, to put together a new platform. So I think there are ways in which this data can be weaponized by the extremists themselves, not just by researchers or law enforcement or archivists, that we need to take into account as well. And that's why I love that Distributed Denial of Secrets is doing the responsible thing here in limiting the distribution to researchers. And I'm wondering if there's going to ever be a limited or subset of the data that will be pushed out to the public itself.
My wife is sitting next to me. Emma Best, one of the co-founders of Distributed Denial of Secrets.
Welcome.
And my wife is sitting next to me throughout this interview, so you may hear some interjections. So I will pass this over to them.
So on the issue of a public release, it's something that we're definitely interested in. That brings with it some challenges, though, in terms of time, because there's some things that just would absolutely have to be removed, like the hashed passwords and the passwords for the groups, which are all plain text. And then there's a lot of discussions that we need to have beyond that, stuff like the email addresses for verified accounts. What do we do with posts that are marked private? Do we make it just public posts, blah, blah, blah. And even after we have all those discussions, that still takes time to execute because, you're talking about a fairly large database. And one of the reasons we went ahead and just decided to offer it up Limbus straight to journalists and researchers was so that we didn't have to introduce this long waiting period, because there's so much that's going on where this is, very recent events, contemporaneous events. This is stuff that, it's an historical archive, but there's a lot of journalists, and we've seen this in the response so far, there's a lot of journalists that could really use this data set now. And so by putting it out this way, we leave all of our options open and kind of get the best of both worlds. And that way we also don't have to sacrifice any of the other things we're working on, because we do have, you know, several other projects that we're dealing with.
How selective are you with the researchers and the journalists? Because I'm thinking, you know, all it takes is one irresponsible person that doesn't care as much as you do about the privacy that could just reveal all kinds of information that really shouldn't be revealed.
We're trying to right now just keep it at we'll give more or less automatic replies and yeses to people that are very well established or, you know, work for a very firmly established outlet or institution. You know, like we get an email from someone using a Washington Post email address, and we know it's legitimate, or like New York Times, just going to go ahead and say, yeah, here you go. Same with think tanks and established researchers. There's more room for discussion when it comes down to the freelancers, because there's a lot of very, very intelligent, very valuable freelancers out there. I see a lot of them still out there, and I've worked with them in the past, but anyone can also call themselves a freelancer. So there's some requests that we're letting sit for a little bit longer while we think about it or figure out exactly how to proceed. You know, most of the people that we've had to turn down are just people that are going, oh, well, I'm just curious.
Yeah. I just kind of want to see what's in there.
I want to see if I'm mentioned anywhere.
Yeah.
And we have kind of an interesting dilemma with anti-fascist groups that are requesting the data, because uh-huh. I mean, pretty much everyone who's part of DDoS or connected to it in any way is anti-fascist. You know, who likes fascism?
Apparently a lot of people, but...
Apparently, if the number is more than zero, that's too many.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But tell us about that dilemma. That's interesting.
Yeah, because when we get requests from anti-fascist groups, I mean, our immediate personal instinct and reaction is always to say yes, because, you know, I mean, these are our comrades, these are our allies, we're, you know, all about anti-fascist work and direct action. But because of the situation, because of the role we're acting in when we're doing DDoS stuff, DDoS secret stuff, we have to look a little bit more closely at them and focus on anti-fascist groups that do research and they publish their findings, because anti-fascists are flat out, undeniably, some of the best researchers on fascists and fascism. The only people that, you know, study fascism more than anti-fascists are fascists.
That's very true. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's also a lot of anti-fascist groups that are much more focused on direct action. Mm-hmm. And again, this is where we get into a little bit of a personal dilemma, because, like, personally myself, big fan of direct action, but that's not what we're doing with DDoS. You know, and we have to make sure that, like, okay, you're not, if we give this to you, are you using it to research and identify things, or are you using it to, like, mess up some Nazis' days? Because as much as we want to see the latter, that's DDoS isn't and can't be in the Nazi harassing business, no matter how funny we think that would be or how much of a public good it would be. That's not the role of DDoS secrets, and it can't be.
No, you're serving a very valuable role, and there are plenty of other organizations that are willing to take on the role of harassing Nazis, so you don't have to worry about that. That will be covered.
Yeah, Rob, and to be clear, we're a big fan of those groups for mm-hmm. the most part. I mean, if you punch a Nazi or you just follow one down playing a tuba so no one can hear them, whatever, you know, we're watching the clips on TikTok, we're watching the YouTube videos, and, you know, we're big fans of that too.
Awesome. Rob, go ahead.
So, Zan and Emma, thank you very much for joining us. I wondered, you were talking about the sorts of individuals and organizations you do want to share this data with, and the way you're releasing it is very fascinating. Have you had like a response in general, if any, to the way in which you're releasing this from, say, the journalists and the researchers?
Mostly just a few people that have questions about how Tor works and how to extract and browse these particular files. Unsurprisingly, a lot of journalists are not very familiar with SQL databases or forms of compression that isn't just .zip.
And yes, it was an SQLI. Oh,
yeah,
and
apparently their chief technical officer also isn't very familiar with SQL issues as well. I'd like to go into a little bit about how this happened in the first place. Apparently, from the account of Fosco Morado, a former Facebook software engineer, who in November became Gab's CTO, on Monday, I'm not sure if it's this week or a previous week, Monday, Gab removed the Git commit from its website, the change that, that Fosco Morado made was a Git commit. That is what basically opened up the security hole. The commit shows a software developer using the name Fosco Morado, introducing precisely the type of rookie mistake that could lead to the kind of breach that was reported over the weekend. Specifically, a line strips the code of reject and filter, which are API functions that implement a programming idiom that protects against SQL injection attacks. I guess, you know, we don't have to get into the specifics here too much, but this is a rookie mistake, is how it's being described in Ars Technica. Anybody can make mistakes, I suppose. But boy, this is something that that really shouldn't happen in a platform like this, correct?
Yeah, I mean, when the source first told me that it was an SQLI vulnerability, because I never try to get too many details because I don't want to know things that I could be compelled to testify about. But, you know, we do have to ask some basic questions. And they said it was SQLI. And, you know, for a while thought like, okay, I wonder if that's just them trying to, you know, come up with something to help cover their tracks. It's a diversion because some sources will try and, you know, get clever like that. After it became public, I started getting several people sending me messages and little excerpts from the public Gab code saying, I'm not positive, but it looks like you could execute arbitrary code here. People found multiple things.
Yeah. I've heard that. I've had friends look at the code multiple times and say, here, 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 here.
Yeah, and I mean, to kind of give everyone listening an idea of just how bad it is, when we were talking about it internally, whenever I first explained it to anyone, like when I talked to Zan or, you know, the other DDoS members, the way I explained it was, I want you to imagine the worst possible way Gab could have been breached.
And I went, no.
Well, it goes beyond that, too. In this Ars Technica piece, there's a section called Revisionist History. Besides the commit raising questions about Gab's process for developing secure code, the social media site is also facing criticism for removing the commits from its website. Critics say the move violates terms of the Affero General Public License, which governs Gab's reuse of Mastodon, an open source software package for hosting social networking platforms. Now, critics say the removal violates terms that require forked source code be directly linked from the site. The requirements are intended to provide transparency and to allow other open source developers to benefit from the work of their peers at Gab. Now, Gab had long provided comments at code.gab.com. Then on Monday, the site suddenly removed all commits, including the ones that created and then fixed the critical SQL injection vulnerability. Now, get this. In their place, Gab provided source code in the form of a zip archive file that was protected by the password, Jesus Christ is King, Trump won the election. I am not making that up. That is...
Yeah, didn't they leave the password in plain text somewhere?
They had to, because it was... Otherwise, it was a violation.
Yeah, they just left the password there.
Real quick, just jumping back half a second, because you mentioned that the Gab code is based off of Mastodon. You know, they did the fork. I just want to be very clear for everyone listening. Gab introduced the vulnerability. I know we kind of said earlier,
yeah.
But this was 100% Gab. They forked Mastodon. They got something that was, you know, pretty dang secure. And then they tweaked it and made it vulnerable on multiple fronts in the most embarrassing way possible.
Okay,
SQLi thing is not Mastodon. Please don't blame Mastodon.
Yes, I'm very glad you made that point.
This is all the white supremacists' fault.
I'm very glad you made that point, but also I think they deserve some credit because what you just described takes a bit of skill to take something secure and turn it into something so insecure. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, as a lawyer and someone who's also been a CISO, I mean, it's hard to get it right all the time, right? But it's also hard to get it that wrong.
It takes some work.
I think to do it that poorly. But what I'm wondering about here, from a legal standpoint, you know, whenever there's a breach that affects a large amount of people, and especially on something like a social media platform like Gab, right? There may be some kind of regulatory scrutiny of those information security practices after the fact, right? So here, I'm wondering if Zan or Emma, you know what Gab had said about its cybersecurity posture before this particular breach. Did they hold themselves out as being as respecting privacy and having a mature or enhanced cybersecurity posture? What did they say about cybersecurity before this breach happened? Because that could determine whether or not there is any kind of governmental or regulatory scrutiny into this breach after the fact.
I can't quite answer that, but I can do you one better. I don't know what they were saying about their security before the breach. But I can tell you that after the breach, I think within a couple hours of Andy Greenberg at Wired reaching out to them for comment, they posted a blog post. And they said that they knew about the vulnerability and had patched it the week before. And it was very much still live. And because of the way Gab's PR handled it, demon hackers, a lot of people were watching as they edited the code in real time and removed the still active vulnerabilities. And one thing we haven't really gotten to yet, because just so much has been going on, because the vulnerabilities were still active, the source, Jack Sparrow, was able to get a little bit more. And the other day we got an update of just the little bit from the window of when they first scraped and sent us the database and when they finally turned off all the vulnerabilities. So we're going to be adding that, I imagine, to what we're offering journalists pretty soon.
Zan, Emma, we're in our last minute, so I just want to give you the opportunity, if there's a way people can help DDoS Secrets or any inspiration you can give to others that might be following this story with rapt attention.
If you want to help out with anything, DDoSSecrets.com/donate. It also has information on how you can contribute. And honestly, just spreading the word about everything we're doing is one of the most helpful things anyone can do.
Well, I want to say what you're doing is really inspirational and responsible, too. I can only imagine if leaks of the past had been handled this responsibly, I think we would have learned so much more from them in a timely fashion.
Yeah, it's important when you have a ship to steer, you have to steer it.
Yeah.
And stick to that, you know, and not a waver while you're handling stuff like this.
In the 30 seconds or so we have left, can you tell us something about the history of the organization, how it started, how you guys were inspired?
Some colleagues approached me basically saying, there's no leak projects or outlets that we feel we can support anymore. We kind of want to help you put together a new one. And they did. They kind of handed over a little bit of technical stuff for me, people I'd known for a few years, and slowly people have been joining up, helping out, and we've just been doing more and more ever since.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Zan and Emma from DDoS Secrets. Wow, what a story. And I'm sure it's going to get better as the weeks go by. Who knows what other platforms are out there as well. Well, we are going to be back in at 8 o'clock for overtime at YouTube, youtube.com/channel2600. You can find us there at 8 o'clock. We'll take your phone calls at 802-321-4225. You can write to us at Off the Hook, OTH@2600.com. We'd love to hear your feedback. But we're going to take a short break now. This is from an album that just got released today by Leonard Sumner, who is from the Indigenous community of Canada. This is pretty awesome. Take a listen.
Started from the res, now I'm living the dream. Wouldn't say it was the bottom, but you know what I mean. Cause I rose to the top, it poetically seems that the next word to rhyme was suggesting a creep. But it was a slow rise, 10 years on the road grind, with plenty of long nights and many of nosedives. Singing these songs like it'd give me a long life beyond what I had, but I know that it's not right. Maybe I lost sight in the lens of a spotlight, and I never thought that I was paying the cost twice. Industry's not nice, it'll burn like a hot knife. Hand me down like a stone in the Klondike. They're looking for gold any way they could get it. Put a price on your spirit if you're willing to sell it. And I told them no, I have never regretted. I am rooted in culture and it's deeply embedded. College never taught me the knowledge I was dreaming of. I was 27 when I learned who I really was. Sitting in the lodge with the drum songs feeding us. Hey, hey, hey. College never taught me the knowledge I was dreaming of. I was 27 when I learned who I really was. Sitting in the lodge with the drum songs healing us. Hey, hey, hey. If I could have told me when I was a young man, not being yourself, well, that's just a dumb plan. You gotta invest in your health and be rested. Aggression is useful, if not misdirected. Lust is for lost ones, so proceed with caution. There's a lot of hurt people, just make sure you're not one. True love is awesome, though the heart can play possum. If the energy's right, it'll make your life blossom. Make room for correction, count on your blessings. Reputation is nothing if you ain't respected. If you have learned something, every loss is a lesson. Being bossed is a notch and everything is connected. Tell your mama that you love her every day of the week. Give thanks to the creator when you wake and you sleep. Life ain't a game, ain't no playing for keeps. We don't take what we own when we finally make peace. College never taught me the knowledge I was dreaming of. I was 27 when I learned who I really was. Sitting in the lodge with the drum songs feeding us. Hey, hey, hey. College never taught me the knowledge I was dreaming of. I was 27 when I learned who I really was. Sitting in the lodge with the drum songs healing us. Hey, hey, hey. Patience is discipline. Love is a medicine. Let me go at your way and dime. I am thankful for everything. I am thankful for everything. Patience is discipline. Love is a medicine. Let me go at your way and dime. I am thankful for everything. I am thankful for everything. College never taught me the knowledge I was dreaming of. I was 27 when I learned who I really was. Sitting in the lodge with the drum songs feeding us. Hey, hey, hey. College never taught me the knowledge I was dreaming of. I was 27 when I learned who I really was. Sitting in the lodge with the drum songs healing us. Hey, hey, hey.
I'm Marcia Pendleton, producer and host of Backstage Stories on WBAI New York. We'll begin our celebration of Women's History Month with artist and activist Lisa Jessie Peterson. From walking the runway for international fashion designers to making her voice heard as a renowned slam poet, author, actor, and Obie-nominated playwright to serving as a teaching artist for at-risk youth, Peterson is a force of nature. Don't miss our conversation with this amazing Renaissance woman on Thursday, March 4th at 9 p.m. on Backstage Stories.
It's Mama Soul here of the Harlem Connection, and I am with
Glory Bell Perez from Barca
on the Mama Soul's Favorite Things episode. It's a takeover, and I have a great guest.
We're talking great food, great times, and we're talking our beloved Harlem.
And there you have it, the Harlem Connection, Fridays at 10 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM New York and WBAI.org.
Woohoo, we did it!
The next meeting of WBAI's local station board will be Wednesday, March 10th at 7 p.m. With this spring season, the LSB looks at how WBAI, which has been navigating the operation and economic challenges posed by COVID, will navigate into the future. There will be an opportunity for public comment. That's the meeting of the WBAI local station board Wednesday, March 10th at 7 p.m. The meeting, held through the Zoom, can be accessed by calling 929-205-6099 and entering the meeting ID 922-457-2995. That's 929-205-6099 and entering the meeting ID 922-457-2995. The telephone number to call is 929-205-6099. The meeting ID is 922-457-2995. A link to instructions, which includes the listening over the web and submitting written comments, is available through WBAI's main webpage. And if you miss an LSB meeting, you can listen afterwards by going to pacifica.org.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. First of all, it's now official. As we reported on Exploration a few weeks ago, the bad news is life expectancy in the United States has dropped a full year. We haven't seen a drop like that since World War II, and of course, it affects African Americans and minorities even more severely. And now, of course, the leading cause of death in the United States is no longer heart disease or cancer. It is the coronavirus. And speaking about the coronavirus, When is the madness going to end? Some people are saying perhaps late July. The bulk of the population will be vaccinated, and maybe we can get back to normal perhaps at the end of this year. Other people are saying, wait a minute, new mutations of the virus keep popping up. In the United States alone, seven, count them, seven new varieties of the virus has been detected. This is in addition to the version of the virus already raging through the United Kingdom and South Africa. And now another one has popped up in Nigeria. So in other words, some people are saying that we may need a booster shot. Not one, not two, but three shots in order to protect the population against these new mutations which keep popping up around the world. And then here's a question. What's the relationship between the coronavirus and global warming? Well, at first you may say to yourself, come on, there is none. And don't think that global warming causes everything that is bad in the world. But a new paper is coming out saying, no, look at the evidence. The evidence shows an indirect correlation between the rise of the coronavirus and global warming. And we'll talk about that. Speaking of which, why is Texas under such extreme stress with ice, with snow, with blackouts, with all sorts of problems dealing with the weather? Some people say, once again, it could be global warming, and we'll talk about that in today's show. And then congratulations to NASA. Yes, the Mars Perseverance probe scored a bullseye on the red planet. And NASA once again has beat the Mars jinx. The Mars jinx is that on average, 60% of all probes that are sent to Mars, well, they never make it. They crash. They don't stop in time and fling off into outer space. But this time, it was a bullseye. So we'll talk about what we expect to get for $2.4 billion. And then news on the medical front. A biomarker, a simple blood test for Alzheimer's. Of course, there's no cure for Alzheimer's disease, which some people think will be the disease of the century as people get older. But the question is there a cheap, simple way to have a blood test to see whether or not you will eventually come down with Alzheimer's disease? And the answer apparently is yes. A new chemical has been found. And it turns out that when people start to show signs of Alzheimer's disease or even before, this biomarker can register the fact that you're going to get Alzheimer's. So we'll talk about this new breakthrough. A simple blood test may reveal whether or not you have Alzheimer's disease. And then, of course, that begs the other question. Why do you want to know? There's no cure for it. Do you really want to know what's eventually going to kill you? Well, some people say yes. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. First, the bad news. As we reported on Exploration a few months ago, life expectancy in the United States, and it's now official, has dropped by one full year. You know, every year we used to get bored when the government would say that once again, life expectancy is marching forward. People are living longer and living happier, healthier lives. Well, not this year. Life expectancy dropped for a full year, the largest drop since World War II. And of course, it affects African Americans and minorities even worse, 2.5-year drop in life expectancy for African Americans. And the leading cause of death every year, it used to be heart disease, followed by cancer. It was almost monotonous hearing these reports, heart disease and then cancer. Well, now the leading cause of death in the United States is the coronavirus. However, there is a little bit of good news, and that is vaccinations are picking up. Almost 2 million doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine are being distributed per day. And then the question that people are asking is, when might we go back to normal? Some people are saying perhaps late July, the bulk of the population will be vaccinated and we will be headed toward herd immunity. At that point, perhaps at 70%, enough people will have been evacuated that there's no room for the virus to grow and infect more people. However, there's a problem, a big problem, a wild card. The wild card is more and more mutations are popping out. You see, the more virus we have, the more possibility of mistakes occurring in the replication of the virus. So the more you have, the higher the probability that it will mutate. And now that the virus has spread all over the entire population of the human race, we expect more mutations to be popping up. First of all, in the United States, it was just announced this week that seven new mutations have been found just in the United States. Of course, we have one in the United Kingdom, one in South Africa, but now we have a third one brewing in Nigeria. And the question is, to fend off all these mutations, will we have to have a booster shot, perhaps a third shot? And the answer is probably yes. Take a look at the seasonal flu. We get inoculated for that once a season. Why? Because it mutates fairly rapidly. Well, originally it was thought that the coronavirus did not mutate that rapidly. But now, however, we are genetically sequencing all the different varieties of the virus around the world. And we're beginning to see that there's a family tree, that mutations are occurring, new branches of the virus are emerging. And some of these are more infectious and more lethal than the original variety. Scientists in particular are zeroing in on what are called the spike proteins. You've all seen pictures of the coronavirus. It looks like a corona and has spikes coming out. These are like keys to the kingdom, because these spikes insert themselves into a lock, which is on the surface of your lung cells. And that's how the virus gains entry into your lungs and perhaps one day kill you. And then the question is, where are these mutations taking place? Well, they are taking place precisely at the spike protein location. That is dangerous, because it means that sooner or later, with more mutations building up around the spike protein, some of these mutations are harmless, but some of them will gain access to the cell's genetic machinery much easier than before and create perhaps yet another pandemic. Already, Pfizer and Moderna, manufacturers of the two most popular vaccines in the United States, are already preparing a booster shot. Already, they're tinkering with the formula by which they created their vaccine, and they're modifying it to guard against these mutations in the spike proteins that are now being seen around the world. And again, seven mutations found just in the United States alone. Now, I should also point out that the statistics behind these mutations is still not well documented. That means that, well, some of these mutations could be harmless. We don't know. All we know is that it's a crapshoot. And if the dice is rolled the wrong way, we could be the victims. So in other words, we're seeing evolution at work. The more mutations we have, the more viruses can spread. The more viruses can spread, the more mutations you get. And you have an exponential proliferation of these mutant versions of the coronavirus. Well, we'll keep you informed, but there's a new report coming out linking global warming and the pandemic. Now, you may say to yourself, come on. I mean, the global warming is the boogeyman for everything. Is everything bad caused by global warming? Well, let's take a look at the data. Scientists are now analyzing the area in Yunnan, China, where the bat population thrives. And it turns out that by looking at records going back 100 years into the past, we see that there's been a change, an abrupt change in the forestation of that area. Forests have sprung up, jungle-like areas have sprung up in that area. And that's exactly where the bat population thrives. The bat population thrives in these forests, and there are 3,000 3,000 different types of coronaviruses affecting this bat population. And again, most of them are harmless. However, it means that on average, each bat species in the Yunnan area carries on an average of 2.7 types of the virus. So in other words, we have a huge reservoir of coronavirus, which is exploding because of the changing temperature and the warming of that area, causing a migration of the forest area where the bats live. Now, to be sure, most are harmless, but a few of them, like MERS and SARS, they have already created panic and pandemics in the eastern part of the world. Also, the pangolin, yet another animal implicated in the chain of infections of the virus, well, it turns out that the pangolin population also has expanded because of the increase.